Okay. Wade, paper two.
Okay, perfect.
Papers two.
Thank you, everyone. Good morning. We will now continue our discussions on accounting for variable payments for asset purchases and payments by an operator to a grantor. So if you recall at the last meeting, the committee asked us to go back and analyze the conceptual principles underlying the leases project and to see if those apply, if the same rationale could apply to asset purchases. So we've gone back and done that. Paper two just presents an overall structure of the papers and provides a summary of our recommendation. Paper 2A walks through the initial accounting, and paper 2B subsequent accounting, and paper 2C then talks about payments by an operator to a grantor. So we'll now focus on paper 2A, on initial recognition and measurement. When we looked at this, we first examined the rationale behind the decisions in the leases project and saw the applicability to asset purchases. That analysis is in paragraph 4 to 23 of our paper. We also looked at accounting for contingent consideration in business combination and saw whether that could apply to asset purchases as well. And because the fundamental issue was whether or not there is a liability and there is a there is the exposure draft and the conceptual framework which clarifies the definition of a liability, we looked at whether the proposals in there would help the committee reach a conclusion on whether or not these payments represent a liability. What we found was that they do provide some additional clarity, but don't necessarily provide a definitive answer that can lead you to a definite conclusion on these payments. And lastly, we also examined whether another model could apply, like something similar to the flip side of the revenue recognition model, where something like variable payments that have a high probability should be recorded as a liability. So we presented all those analyses. And on balance, we think and we recommend that the business combination principles should be applied to the initial recognition and measurements for variable payments. So in accordance with this, the fair value of all variable consideration, including those that are dependent on future activity, would be included in the initial measurement. On balance, we think that this more faithfully represents the economic consideration that is exchanged, and it also reduces the pressure on the distinction between an asset and a business, which is one of the points that came out of the PIR of business combination. So with that, I'd like to ask my first question on whether you agree with our analysis and our recommendation to apply the business combination principles.
Comments? Don't everybody jump in at once. Andrew?
I'm really quite concerned about the measurement challenges of recognizing fair value on day one for all of these payment obligations. And the paper does refer to the cost and complexity of the business combinations approach on day one, but it doesn't really get into factors such as, I think in a typical business combination with an earnout, the earnout period wouldn't normally go beyond 3 years. Certainly 5 years is very rare. I think some of what we're dealing with here, and it is a broad range of transactions, we're talking about some very long, I call it contingency periods. I think the nature of the contingencies in things like maybe a pharmaceutical drug compound at the development stage, some of the contingencies are extremely uncertain. So I think the measurement challenges will be significantly greater in comparison to a business combination. I don't really buy the argument that somehow these transactions are more analogous to business combinations than they are to leases, in all truth. And I think the discussion we're having after lunch about changing the definition of a business is going to create a greater distance between asset purchases and business combinations. And I'm also not quite convinced that, I'm concerned that recognizing the full fair value on day one is going to result in recognizing liabilities that may not be liabilities. And the analysis of the guidance on liabilities in the revised conceptual framework is very helpful, but I don't think that puts it beyond doubt as to whether you've got a liability if the payment is dependent on your future activity. I think a linkage to entity-wide revenue in an IAS 32 context, I would agree that's not within your control, But a decision as to whether or not to generate usage or sales out of a particular item, a particular asset, does seem like much more of a future operating activity than an obligating event to me. So I had some concerns.
Reinhardt?
My comments are very similar to Andrew's, although on the one hand I agree with the staff's analysis of the pros and cons, business combination accounting relative to leases. I think the whole issue, the broad issue of when does a liability exist, when it's dependent, the measurement is dependent on future performance, is a very broad issue, not really resolved by the conceptual framework. And so I'm, like Andrew, concerned about going down the path of taking the principles in business combination accounting to this scenario. I just personally think it's too broad an issue and has a lot of complexities, interrelationships with some of the other principles in IS 32, and that I think it's best dealt with by the ISB itself, as opposed to we trying to come up with guidance in this respect. As I say, I think my biggest concern is the lack of clarity as to the extent to which future performance affects the recognition and measurement of the liability on day one.
Martin?
Same views as Andrew and Reinhardt, but in addition, for me, the question would be, what is the relevant information? Is the relevant information about a potential obligation, and what is driving the change of that obligation? The change of that obligation is the probability of success. So that means linked with the obligation is also, in a way, a certain value, so a certain type of asset, in a way. So that for me, generates a different kind, at least conceptually, obligation than an ordinary obligation where you have no economic benefits combined with that obligation. I agree that measurement could be very, very challenging, specifically if you have long-lasting projects. And here I have a specific challenge in the paper 2A. We only discuss it with regard to initial measurement and not subsequent measurement. And I should already, at this point in time, consider whether I agree with the business combination principles. However, I guess we have to answer this in a combined way with regard to initial and subsequent measurement, and in a few seconds I tell you why. With regard to business combinations, I also see other challenges. For example, is then the philosophy of pre-existing relationship the same if I have already licensed in a part of the assets or so? So conceptually, I have more topics. And now I start already to have a little bit the link to the subsequent measurement, but consider you have a probability weighted measurement of your obligation. And it might be that you adjust the probability at each balance sheet date, and you adjust your asset. What would that mean for, and I guess this is missing in the overall argumentation, what would that mean for your amortization depreciation over time? Because every time you would adjust your asset, it would also impact your future, well, costs in your COGS. And I believe that it is a very high value to have internal and external accounting aligned as far as possible. However, I really fear if we would adjust the asset for circumstances which are potentially happening in the future but not that assured, so for example an increase of probability from 10% to 30%, which would affect my amortization schedule, that it's very, very heavily to explain to investors and also to those people who really focus on these kinds of costs. So I really see a practical issue. So therefore, I only would, well, agree with that concept if potentially one has a higher hurdle, for example, like IFRS 15, which is discussed in the paper, whether this would be an appropriate approach. Overall, however, I believe that the topic is, well, not an issue about interpretation. It is really a conceptual issue, and has to be, well, aligned with the IRSB and finally more or less solved by the IRSB. I do not believe, with regard to the mandate the Interpretation Committee really has, that this could be solved by the Interpretation Committee.
Okay. I've got a whole Christmas tree going here, but Bonnie, did you want to come in at this point, or do you want to hang back?
I'll hang back for a little bit.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, let's just go around the room, starting with Young Soo.
Right. I actually personally support the, you know, the staff decision or conclusion. You know, we have to adopt the business combination principle. The reason is that, you know, we have to report everything that has happened in the company in the past, if that is measurable and if it is possible. But, you know, even though I personally support the step conclusion, I concur with all the other arguments that has already been made. You know, there are a lot of problems in deciding whether we have to recognize the performance-based variable payment as a liability because of the measurement problem. And also there are, I mean, if I add one more thing, that there are a lot of inconsistencies between accounting standards about the variable, you know, the performance-based variable payment, IAS 32, 37, and also the new ED on the leases. And if we say, you know, business combination principle in the IFRIC, then it's gonna add another conflict between accounting standards also. So what I'm trying to say is that we have to decide whether we're going to recognize the performance-based variable payments as a liability before we, talk about this agenda paper. So I agree with a kind of the Martin that this is not what the IFRS Interpretations Committee has to do, but, you know, we have to refer the ISB to think about whether we have to recognize the performance-based variable payment as a liability or not.
Okay, I'm going to pose a question to all subsequent speakers. I understand the impulse to kick this over to the board. The board has tried to deal with this issue on several occasions and been, by and large, unsuccessful. Just read the basis for conclusions on leases. So if it is the sense of this committee that the board needs to take another look at this, the question I would put to you is, what do we have to tell the board now that we didn't have in the previous situations that we've tried to pass this over to the board? Because there's a darn difficult question. I'm not criticizing the board, but they've been unable to deal with it to date. So if we're going to ask them to take another shot, I think it's incumbent on us to give them some advice as to how they might do it. Fei Long?
Yes, I have the similar concern with Andrews. And the rationale for staff recommendation applying the business combination principles is that it would be provide a more conceptual, robust solution. Given the variable payment depending on future activities not meet the definition of liability, therefore adopting the business combination is probably high to say is a more conceptual, robust solution. By the way, if taking the approach recommended by the staff, it will be a significant change from current practice. Entities will incur significant costs for in estimating the fair value of variable payments. That could be an issue for the preparers, and also the estimation may may be highly subjective and uncertainty. And what we are talking about right now is the variable payment for PPE. If we take that, how about for inventory?
Okay, Bruce.
Thanks, Mike. I agree that there's a challenge on this, but I was going to make a similar comment to what you've made, that I mean the board have tried to address this a number of times and it's been quite difficult. I actually, when I read the paper, I actually went the other way on it. When I took a look at it, to me, these economically, these transactions were more akin, in my mind, to a lease than to a business combination. And I think it's because we are in a situation where we're looking at how you're dealing with payments on the purchase of an asset. And I guess in response to what Wayne's question was in terms of, well, where's the board now? To me, we're imminently going to see the end of a very, very long process on leases that's been kind of debated now by, I think, probably a number of board members and past board members. It gives us a, for want of a better word, a framework in terms of, I don't like to use the word framework, but some sort of basis in terms of how we're going to approach these types of transactions. I think that in light of what the decisions that have been made on leasing, that's the approach I would take to say we've now got something, we've bashed out, we've reinvented the way that we're going to look at the purchase of assets, we reinvented the way liabilities arise in terms of that, how we're dealing with payments in terms of leases, and yeah, as I said, my when I read the two arguments, to me, I would have definitely probably gone the other way and said, probably similar to the comment that was made earlier, there are so many different bases in IFRS. To me, if we could align it to leases, I think would be a much better answer and probably easier to explain.
Given the fact that you all hated leases last time.
Yeah, but I guess you're right, but is it the best of two evils is kind of where I'm going, because I agree with what you said. The board is not just going to suddenly find a miracle solution, unless maybe they've come up with it now, but I'm saying given where we are imminently with having leases, isn't it better to try at least align it with it?
Charlotte?
I suppose I haven't seen a huge conceptual difference between the leasing and the business combination, because I was of the view that the reason that you didn't include the liability that was linked to future performance in leasing was a practical answer, a sort of a cost-benefit one. So I suppose if we thought it was a cost-benefit, and may have different views about that reason for not including it then, I don't know why we couldn't include it in this, just say if it isn't practical or you can't calculate the liability, that's the reason to exclude it. I do think conceptually, and even before the conceptual framework proposed amendments, that it was a liability and the question was one of measurement rather than one of recognition.
Carl?
All right, thanks. Even though the business combination principles being robust, I really do not support to apply this for asset purchase. Additionally, for service concession arrangement as well. I believe it will turn daily life rather complex for the whole accounting community. I think it brings a very high level of measurement uncertainty and probably more demand for pro forma financial statements, which is already high. Furthermore, my sense is that the benefits really do not outweigh the disadvantage. Thus, I'm still in favor to align the leases measurement, and especially my main concern, remeasurement approach in this project. I'm certain the advantages are in the lease projects are much more relevant than the advantages, especially for daily life and practical concerns.
John?
I mean, personally, the easiest question I found to answer here was about the approach, because to me, these are liabilities, and the business combination approach actually recognizes that they're liabilities, they're contractual obligations to pay cash, and it's all a question of measurement. I'm also troubled that if we go down a path which says that business combinations, you sort of treat these as liabilities and recognize them, measure them, but for asset acquisitions, we end up in a completely different model, which says they're, or pretends they're not liabilities. I think the more difficult question is the scope of this and the measurement difficulties, the scope of transactions this actually applies to, and what type of exemptions and practical expedience and so forth would you have to create to make this sort of workable and operational? And at one end of the spectrum, you know, there's a large element of risk-sharing arrangements about some of these. It's between the purchaser and the seller. There's an agreement to share the risks of future activities. But personally, my own view is there's a liability here, and it should be recognised, and it's all a question about how we actually measure it.
Bob? I agree with the result of the staff analysis to treat the initial measurement like a business combination. I don't reach the conclusion because of, I think it's more analogous to a business combination. I can find as many analogies to a lease as a business combination. For me, it's going back to, like John said, I believe that what we have here is a liability. I do believe it meets that you're obligated, what the contingency relates to is the measurement as the amount, and I think it's a more relevant measure for the asset. Now, I don't mean to belittle at all the difficulty in making that measurement. I do recognize that is a major issue. I think part of the problem we're having is that we have inconsistency in the literature, both in the pay side and the receive side on contingent consideration. And not surprisingly, it's a problem regarding, it goes back to relevancy versus uncertainty in measurement. And I think we have to make a decision. So to answer Wayne's question about what would we tell the board, there's nothing new here. There's nothing new to explore. It's a decision that just has to be made as to do you side in this case more on relevancy or on the uncertainty of the measurement?
Tony?
I think my comments are actually very similar to Bob and John. And I wonder if, I guess I wouldn't have started from the perspective of saying, am I adopting a leases approach or a business combinations approach? I would have adopted this, I would approach this question by saying, is there a liability? And that would be my starting point. So is there something that meets the definition of a financial liability? And I'm inclined to agree with John and Bob. I think there is something that meets the definition of a financial liability. I think IS 32 says that, for example, the revenues of an entity is not something that would push you outside the scope of IS 32. And so I'd start from there. And so I think there is a financial liability. I recognize the challenges. I think what we said last time, and I continue to believe, is that the leasing standard is specifically scoped out from everything else. And so if we wanted to go down a route of saying something similar to the leases model, then we'd have to be saying these transactions are outside the scope of IS 32. I understand that there are going to be challenges, and I think it does come back to saying, well, is the relevance of the information about the obligation to pay cash outweighed by the measurement uncertainty if you have a 30-year service concession in a high inflation environment and all the stuff that goes with it? But to me, that's where the tension is the relevance of saying this is a liability, it ought to be on the books, outweighed by the fact that the measurement is going to be uncertain. I'm not sure that in every case the measurement is going to be sufficiently uncertain, but I do think that's where the judgment is actually sitting.
Hey. Bonnie, did you want to come in now?
Sure. I think my comments are more in line with Martin and Andrews, and I think Reinhardt also agreed that I'm not sure that this is a liability. I also agreed with some of Martin's comments on the practical challenges with not only measurement on the initial transaction, but also from a subsequent transaction. So I don't agree that this is a liability, and I think that if you do agree that this is a liability, there are some significant issues with the measurement uncertainty. And I'm not sure that the subjectivity that would be required to measure that would outweigh the benefits of providing that information.
Thank you, Bonnie. Sue, board member privilege.
I'd agree with Tony that if you picked up IAS 32 and put these transactions through it, I think you would conclude it's a financial liability. Whether you like that answer or not, I think that's what 32 says, because it talks about things like revenue not being within the control. And so I would agree with that. And while I think the measurement uncertainty point is certainly an interesting thing and a relevant, excuse the pun, consideration, we have plenty of other liabilities that are in the scope of 32 that aren't very easy to measure, but we don't say that that's a reason in and of itself. So I think we'd need something more if we were to go down that path to give to the board. I think on leasing, the board has looked both at whether, well, it's thought about liabilities slightly differently, I think, to 32. So we've got an issue in terms of scope. But also I think what was relevant, at least from my point of view, in that discussion was also not just that an individual liability would be difficult to measure, but that there could very well be circumstances where people had very big portfolios of these complex instruments, and it would be a very difficult thing to do. So I think the cost-benefit analysis was very particular to that leasing project. Also, I think in leasing, we looked at very much the relationship between the asset and the liability. We haven't touched too much on that linkage point in the discussions.
Lee? No, you're on now.
No. I'm very much undecided on this one. I think it's Andrew made a point that as board member, I would like to see not only the initial measurement but the subsequent measurement together. I think we need to have a broad view of this item. I don't disagree that in principle there is a liability. The question to me is more a cost-benefit analysis. What information does it provide to users, to investors? Not necessarily on the day one. I think investors need to know on day one there is a liability out there. The question is when this amount of liability changes, and because there is a lot of uncertainty, there will be a lot of changes every day in that estimate of liability. What information will investors derive from it? What use is it to them? Either adjusting the asset or putting the variation in P&L. Are you going to make any use of the P&L information if we adjust by P&L? Debits and credits to P&L, big amounts. Are you going to put any multiple? What are you going to do with it? And if we decide that the subsequent measurement is to adjust the asset for the corresponding amount of the liability with all the complexities of what pertains to the past, what pertains to the future, how much of the adjustment should be taken to the asset or should be taken to P&L, is that going to provide any relevant information to you? I don't know. And in front of that, I have the cost of the system, the cost of the measurement, the cost of all the adjustments. So on a cost-benefit basis, I'm not sure that the good conceptual argument really meets the cost-benefit test. But I'd like to know more, to hear more from investors, users on that topic, because I'm not quite decided.
Okay. Sandy, you haven't been in yet, and then we'll go back to Martin and Hyung-Soo.
I guess I turned my light on when we were talking about leases and the like. I guess from our perspective as a user organization, we've said that relevance always overrides reliability, and that makes some people, you know, shocks some people. But, you know, I guess I'm concerned with analogizing to leases. Not because I don't believe it's a liability, I believe it's a liability, but we only supported the leases standard because we want them to be recognized. We are not happy with the measurement. We don't believe it accurately reflects the value of these instruments. We believe that probability weighted estimates of the lease payments would have been a better measurement. So in this context, analogizing to leases is a bit of a problem for us. But I guess my bigger concern as I went through these papers was sort of like, here we go again, right? We're never going to come to an answer. So how much time do I want to spend on this? Because as a user group, we run into this all the time, right? That in our view, it gets to the relevance of financial statements in their entirety, because we say, oh, if it's just too hard to measure, we shouldn't put it in, because users will be confused by it. And that's really not the case, because we're saying that management took a decision to enter into a contract that has a high degree of uncertainty in it, but we can't possibly reflect that in the financial statements because it's just too hard. But investors are investing in a company that's producing financial statements that don't tell them that, in fact, management made a really hard decision and it may turn out good or bad. So to Philippe's point, you know, it depends on what kind of user of financial statements you actually are. If you're a sell-side analyst who believes the world is flat and you want earnings to be highly predictable, you're probably going to say, I don't want this in here. If you're a buy-side analyst who's truly long the investment, you're going to say, I want to know it, good, bad, or indifferent, and I don't just look at the income statement. I look at the total value of the enterprise. The problem is that there will never be disclosures. We'll never come to a consensus on disclosures that will accurately communicate the information to the users of the financial statements so that they can actually see the sensitivity of these estimates, because they're going to apply them, and they're probably going to have conversations with management outside of the financial statements about them. So sophisticated investors are going to have more information than unsophisticated investors, because they're going to sit with investor relations and actually understand what these contracts are about.
Just go back to that. I'd like to better understand how you would use information which says, you know, I remeasure my liability for the next 30 years. Big amount, you call it 30 years effect, even though you may discount it. And I take all that variation to my P&L today. Some people could say, okay, you have more benefits because if you remeasure you increase your liability, it's because the asset is performing better than expected. But what you have in the current year is only 1 year of this increase in benefits, not the next 30 years of estimated future increases. So to say there is a matching in a way between the better than expected performing asset and the 30 times more remeasurement of liability that you take to the current P&L as a debit today, seems to me somewhat counterintuitive. I'm sorry, I'm maybe a dinosaur, but only 6 months to go, so after that, we go to fair value. You can do to fair, full fair value. I don't object.
I may be the wrong person to ask that question of, because my background is insurance, right? So I haven't met an actuary who can't estimate anything, right? So, you know, the question is, I mean, it's all you know about it is that it's wrong as an investor. You know it's wrong. The question is, and it's not just this one moment in time, it's how it behaves over time, right? So you're going to see, if you measure it, what items actually change the liability or change the asset and how it behaves. And you're going to make your own estimates of how you think it behaves. But, you know, management is doing that as well. Management's looking at whether this deal is still a good deal or a bad deal. We're just not telling anybody it in the financial statement. That's our struggle. I agree, it's wrong. The question is, how wrong is it, and is it more wrong not to tell someone how this instrument behaves when conditions change?
I say we cannot make disclosures better. I'm a bit surprised. We can try to make disclosures
better. Well, I agree.
Better.
Maybe that's just chalk that up to a bit of cynicism at the moment, because we always seem to think, oh, they're just going to be so confused by those, you know, voluminous disclosures, right? But if they want to find them, they will find them, and they will use them.
Michael?
Yeah, just think about some of the concerns, Philippe, that I think you were highlighting there about putting the remeasurement through profit or loss. And in the papers, we did dissect this down into the initial measurement and then the subsequent measurement. And for the initial measurement, you know, we were saying that, look, we think it's better and more informative to put an estimate of the liability onto the balance sheet, even when that liability is subject to variability that includes the performance of the entity. And then when it comes to the subsequent measurement, we thought, yes, that, you know, whilst the business combinations guidance itself would say all the variability goes through profit or loss, We were saying, well, actually, there could be circumstances here where actually it's more informative to add that variability, add or minus it, to the asset that you've acquired, because it's reflecting better information as time goes by about the cost of the asset. So I think there is a way of being able to overcome the concerns that you described, Philippe.
I know that, Michael, but I've been in this business of star setting for nearly 10 years, and now I've learned that I don't make a decision on piecemeal basis. I want to know the whole story before I make a decision, and I'm no longer accepting, make a decision now and forget about the next steps.
Martin?
Thanks, Swain. Probably coming back to your question, what do we tell the board? If I remember it correctly, Sue started last time the discussion with regard whether leasing is the appropriate link, so to say. And it might be a legitimate argument, but the interpretation committee so far was on the track, well, we try to align it with the lease project, and we were on that way that the outcome could be appropriate. Now we got signals from the board, or at least board members, that probably the lease project is, there are so many scoped out and it is so something extraordinary that the solution out of the lease project does not fit. So that could be an answer to shift it back to the board. With regard to Sandy, I agree that this information might be important for investors, but then we have to consider that we are not talking about a fair value information of the asset, because the adjustment of the liability does not tell you anything about the fair value of the asset, because with the asset we are still on a so to say cost measurement model. I see the difference between the liability and asset side, although, as said before, if I have to pay an additional amount, for sure, I would have potential additional future resources due to the fact that overall the asset has a higher implied value. That means if I step up the asset, I do not step it up to fair value, but I just step it up to the amount I potentially pay. With regard to the question of subsequent accounting, I believe, although it is not that explicit in the framework, that matching is an important issue also for analysts, and the whole discussions with regard to levies, according to my point of view, it is because of matching, because it does not fit economically, it does not fit, and personally I really fear that if we start to have a probability weighted measurement and an impact on the overall amortization schedule, with the impact on COGS and a specific management judgment bias, so to say. So if I were to have lower COGS in the next periods, I probably are potentially a little bit more aggressive in valuing my obligation. And 1 or 2 years later, specifically if I have very long-lasting obligations, I might generate a different view. So. For me, it would be important to come closer to a concept of realization or highly probable realization, which would be in line more with the ideas of the revenue recognition standard, so that I do not adjust my obligation at each balance sheet date, but if it becomes really more probable, more realistic, not the step up in 10 and 30%, but at a point in time when I say, okay, I do not believe that this step up will be withdrawn in the future again. So, but this is challenging to defend from a pure conceptual and theoretical basis.
Question to the staff. The piece that people are referring to as missing is really just amortization, right? Depreciation. We didn't touch on that in the papers. presumably whatever standard governed the depreciation would continue to apply. Okay, let's do Ryan Art, Andrew, Young Su, and then let's see if we can bring this around to something.
Just very briefly, quickly, I think the comments that were made in terms of considering initial recognition and subsequent measurement together is a good one, because if we, as Sue said, if we accept that IS 32 and IS 39 provide guidance that there is a financial liability, then I think the issue I have is that guidance is very clear as to the subsequent measurement. It goes to the P&L. Same with IFRS 3, as you mentioned, Michael, it goes to the P&L, but I sense there is discomfort with that, and people would like to see something capitalized in certain circumstances where there's an enhancement of the benefit of the asset. And the model where that exists is leasing, as much as we perhaps can argue it's not, there's practical accommodations that are made, et cetera. So I think what I would say, Wayne, in terms of the issue to raise with the board is exactly that, is this, do we have a different model for these kinds of arrangements that other than what would be suggested by perhaps considering this a financial liability and the accounting under IS 39, 32, or using the business IFRS 3 type model, because again, as a package, the subsequent subsequent accounting in terms of showing everything into the P&L for a long term arrangement, as Andrew was saying, where it could be over 20, 25 years, that strikes people as not being perhaps the best in the circumstances.
Question for you, Reinhardt, and maybe I'll turn this to Sue as well. My understanding is that 39 tells you it goes to the income statement if it's interest.
Well, I think what I was looking to is AG8. Yeah, all adjustments. When you change your estimate of future cash flows, you have to adjust your liability, and it's clear. So the offset goes to P&L.
So you don't get that out of saying, well, if it's something other than interest, okay.
That's the issue.
Yeah. Just one point on that. I think previously when the committee discussed it, and it's somewhere in the subsequent recognition in the appendix, I think when the committee first looked at subsequent recognition and measurement, they came to the point where they said IS 39 says it should go to the P&L, but they felt it would be unless another standard specified otherwise. They thought it wasn't very clear, and you would need an amendment to, at that time, paragraph AG8 of IS 39 to reflect the decision of the committee too. But they did think that it is possible to put it to the cost of the asset, because they looked at borrowing costs, for example, and said that can be capitalized. So just wanted to point that out as well.
We do capitalize the changes in the IAS 37 liabilities too, so it's not without precedent. Gary, board member privilege.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, by the way, the IAS papers are very well written and very clear. I understand the relative arguments for leasing versus business combinations, but they didn't convince me either way. I'm actually open-minded as to where this may go. But someplace in paper 2A, you had said that there are analogies to leasing, but you did not make a similar comment that there's analogies to business combinations. Is that deliberate because you don't think there are any?
We did say that they are similar because a purchaser obtains control of the asset, but it was just a shorter paragraph,
okay.
I think, when
okay.
we did.
Because I can tell you, it feels more analogous to leasing, than it does to business
right.
combinations
yeah.
to me. But if we're going to go forward with this, and with the recommendations to follow business combinations accounting, where I can see all the exact same issues on variable payments that came back on leasing, hard to estimate. You have to separate what's a true contingent earn out versus future performance, which may or may not be part of the basis, and so on. And we will certainly get reminded that for the most part in leasing, we did not conclude variable payments meet the definition of a liability vis-a-vis being accrued. Would you expect there'd be different feedback if we went the business combinations route?
I think as Sue mentioned, I think like in terms of asset acquisitions, it might be that entities have fewer such contracts, as opposed to having a high volume of such contact, that could be one consideration. And I also think in terms of the relevance argument for asset purchases, it might be more relevant when compared to leases potentially. So those could be some of the things that bring you to a different answer.
Yeah, but it still seems to me the one of the pushbacks on variable lease payments was difficulty in measurement, uncertainty, and what separated true or at contingent payment versus future use. I really can't see there'd be any difference in the feedback you'd receive, and ultimately, as you know, that did not make it into being capitalized and leasing up front.
Mikhail, you haven't been in yet. Sorry, your light was on. I wondered.
I didn't touch it.
Oh, okay.
No, sorry.
My mistake then. Okay, we're starting to recycle, pardon the expression, recycle here. So let's see if we can't try and find a way to wrap this up. Andrew and then Young-Soo.
Yeah, just really briefly, there have been some quite sweeping statements about whether these things are liabilities or not liabilities. And maybe we have different things in our minds when these statements are being made. IS-32 says that a contingent settlement provision is not a liability if it's within the control of the issuer, and it goes on to say that an entity's revenues and net income are not within its control for that purpose. I can tell you, I think if you have an instrument that says you have to make a payment if you sell product A, that would not be regarded as a liability in terms of IS-32 practice, to the best of my knowledge and belief. So I think an entity's wide revenues and a specific revenue stream, for better or for worse in practice, are dealt with differently for IS-32 purposes. And maybe that's something that the debt equity project needs to take a look at, what's within your control and what isn't. But I am just concerned, without further analysis, that this broad statement, is it a liability or not a liability, given predominant practice right now?
I think we should, is that going to be on the record as the view of the Interpretations Committee? We just better be careful, I think, with that statement.
It's my view. But
Young-Soo?
I think that the things are getting complicated because we are trying to mix too many things together, like the initial measurement, subsequent measurement, depreciation, amortization measurement. So I think that what we have to do is to go for a very basic issue, which I think is the same as what Andrew said, if there's any existence of liability, especially for the variable payment on the performance. So that the first thing that we have to do is to think about it. I mean, the board has to think about it, because we are talking about some kind of general assets, not the special asset like the lease. So that before we apply the lease of principles onto this one, we have to think about whether there is really some kind of a liability exists for the performance-based variable payments, especially for the general asset. So if we decide that, then we can go for the next steps, like the other measurement issues or the other subsequent recognition issues and stuff like that.
Philippe?
Another point is maybe consistency with IFRS 15. If you have a liability, so someone must have a receivable, right? Now let's assume it is a license, this asset you purchase. A license which is a sales-based royalty license. Under 15, you don't have a receivable until the sales are made by the licensee. So if you are the licensee, you don't have a liability to the licensor until you have made the sales, right? So this is a variable payment license. I think we should have some consistency with revenue recognition as well.
Marie?
I think it's an issue we often met. Today, there's a lot of diversity in practice regarding the initial measurement, but also the initial recognition, but also the measurement. So I think in the accounts, I fully agree that today it's difficult to find any disclosure about that. So I think it's a main issue. I also agree that it's a difficult one, and maybe because there is a lot of literature, and depending on where you go, you have different ideas. I do agree that the first question is maybe, do you have a liability? And if you go to IS-32, there is one, of course. But maybe we can see with the framework or the ED on the framework as well. So maybe it's a question to ask to the board. But I think after, it's important that the IFRSCC or someone just carry on working on this issue, even if it's a huge one, because it's really something we often met with a lot of diversity.
John?
I've had the benefit of being here in 2012 when we had this debate, and it basically sounds like I've got into a time machine and gone back 3 years in time, because it's the same debate again about whether there's a liability or not, and there seems to be equally strong views on both sides that there is a liability and there's not a liability. So I think if we're going to look at a way forward, I mean, what we did 3 years ago was we said, well, let's actually park whether there's a liability or not a liability and see if we can make progress on what we think some answers about subsequent accounting might be, whether you recognize or don't recognize. Now, that sounds like a very sort of strange thing to do, to talk about subsequent measurement when you can't agree on initial recognition. But it seems to me that if we were going to advise the board of anything, it might be to do with subsequent measurement approaches, and let them resolve the issue of conceptually whether there is or is not a liability, because I don't think we're going to resolve it in this particular forum. Just a second comment back to the point about AG8. We did discuss before AG8, and the view of the committee at that time was that AG8 does not allow you, unless another standard requires the capitalization of that, it goes to P&L. And IAS 16 and IAS 38, the conclusion at that time was, do not currently provide for the AGA true-up adjustment to be capitalized, so an amendment to IAS 16 and IAS 38 would have been required.
Okay. Bob and Tony, and then I'm going to pull the plug on this.
I just wanted to add quickly on this issue around whether it's a liability or not. In my training, I was always taught to break transactions down into their legs, and so for me, what we're talking about is I buy an asset from party A for cash, and then with party B, I receive the same amount of cash, and I exchange with them I give them a royalty stream. Now, I think if I look at it that way, when I receive that cash in exchange for giving them a future royalty stream, I don't think that's that is a immediate gain or immediate revenue. I think I have an obligation to deliver cash. I think I have a liability there. So that's just on the other side of the argument for why I think it's a liability.
Tony?
I guess much the same. My concern with this one, and I probably share John's concern that we're not necessarily going to come to a landing on whether it is or isn't a liability. But I just get a little bit concerned that what we have to do is interpret what we have first. We may not like the answer, and then maybe the suggestion is to the board that something ought to be changed. But I just get worried when we start running ahead with analogizing to this or analogizing to that and not interpreting what we actually have. And fine, we may interpret it and we may collectively think that for whatever reason we don't like that accounting. But before we analogize to IFRS 15, I don't think the books of the world have to balance. So the fact that there's an artificial constraint inserted in IFRS 15 doesn't, to me, drive the accounting on the liability side, nor does thinking about the debates we've had around levies, they're not financial liabilities. It seems to me the key question here is, does this meet the definition of a financial liability in IAS 32? That then drives the rest of the accounting. I agree we'd have to change AG8 to get to the subsequent measurement if that's what we wanted to do, but I think that's the threshold question. And I'm just concerned about analogies or whatever, because I'm not sure where that stops. I don't like this, I can't measure it. Where does that stop in terms of moving you out of the guidance that we actually have? I do think we need to sort of stop and think, okay, can we get past that threshold question?
Okay. I think, Michael, did you want to comment?
I was just going to say, based on some of the conversations this morning, particularly what Tony's just said and what Andrew had said earlier, the question about is there a liability, and I think I heard that it comes down to, is the future performance in the control of the entity? Because, Andrew, you referenced the sort of the revenues example, and you were saying, well, there's a difference between a revenue stream and the entity-wide revenues. Now, is that where the committee ought to be focusing, or perhaps asking the board to focus?
I think, let me try it a little bit differently. As I recall, when we first got this issue, the thing that we found troublesome was that the adjustment that was driving the revision in the liability, and this within the context of service concessions, the adjustment that was driving the revision in the liability was an inflation adjustment. And so the company had to pay more for its concessions. But congratulations, you could collect more from the people who drove their cars over the bridge. And simply putting it to the income statement created an accounting mismatch, because the asset had been enhanced. We didn't have any ability to recognize the enhancement of the asset other than falling back on an IAS 37 type analogy and saying, well, if the liability increases, we must have enhanced the asset at least that much. And then we got seduced, attracted to, I don't know what, the idea of waiting for leases to get done. And so we're all the way, as John reminds us, all the way back around to where we started from. I don't see a consensus around the table on this issue. I read the comments as an awful lot like the basis for conclusions in the leasing document. This might or might not be a liability, but it's damn hard to measure, and there's so much measurement uncertainty that perhaps we ought not to go there. Now, yes, it's not the same as leases because you don't have a portfolio of 10,000 locations, all of which have a lease that has this feature. But it is a similar situation. We did ask the staff, for staff, this is the second meeting in the row, whether they've done what they were asking them. We've said, no, we don't. God, whose idea was that? So I'm not seeing a consensus on this one. The only thing that remains in my mind, and I don't see any basis for us to tell the board to go do something with it. The only thing they can do with it is to resolve whether these things constitute liabilities. So I'm not seeing a path out of this other than maybe the last paper, which says let's carve out, find a better term, but let's just deal with the service concession questions, because service concessions are like leases, kind of in their own little world. And maybe we can hack away at that and say the bigger issue is just too big, and we don't have any consensus on how to solve the bigger issue. Does that sound like an approach worth taking? Anybody object to taking that approach? Okay, do you want to then introduce the service concessions only paper? We'll set the other two aside and try and figure out what we're going to say about them for a bit.
Absolutely. So I'll get into paper 2C on service concessions. And we looked at whether service concessions are a unique type of arrangement that could be analyzed separately and kept away from the broader issue. And we agreed that on the basis of our analysis, we agreed that it does have unique characteristics. And when we look at it, it does have some more similarities with leases because it does create ongoing rights and obligations on the part of the operator. And there may be more of a basis to actually apply the leasing principles to service concession arrangements and not apply it to the broader issue. We would like to point out that if FIC 12 does acknowledge that where you have the intangible asset model and you have an intangible asset that arises out of a service concession arrangement, there is nothing special about the intangible asset, and therefore it directs you to IAS 38 to account for that intangible asset. So if we do go down the path of trying to create a solution just within FIC 12, we will have to scope out these payments from IAS. We think that we will have to scope out these payments from IAS 38 and then deal with the accounting either within IFRIC 12 or by analogizing to the principles in leases or whatever the principles we decide. So what we would like to see is, if we are going down this path, do you agree with the approach of looking first at the leasing principles as a good starting point and seeing how the solution can be worked out?
Comments? Carl?
Yes, I support this approach.
My only disagreement is about the application of IS 38 to service concession arrangements. I think when it was IS 38 was designed, concessions wasn't really in the mindset. Therefore, probably some kind of carve-out can be applied to specific situations in concessions when we talk about remeasurement of the intangible assets and liability as well. I can't find a clue of concessions during reading the IS 38. I cannot find.
Others? Exhaustion has set in. Reinhardt.
I think along the lines of what Carl was saying, I certainly see benefit to continuing down the path of looking to apply or provide some guidance in the context of service concession arrangements. I think, though, the issue that you raised, Wayne, is the, and that Jawed raised as well, is intersection with IS 38, and as you were saying, that where there's an increase in the amount that the operator would have to pay, there may be an increase in the intangible asset, and so there may be need to make some scoping out of IS 38. But I do think it's worth pursuing that path.
Wade, when we say pursuing that path, how many more times do we have to talk about this?
Well, I think if people are happy with the leasing principles, I think we just go work them out and come up with proposed amendments. Like, the decisions on service concessions for every other scenario have been worked out in terms of, for example, where there's a financial asset model. And at the last meeting, everyone confirmed that they were generally happy with those previous decisions as well. So we will take that, apply the leasing principle in cases where there is the intangible asset model, and bring up the proposed solution at the next meeting, if everyone's happy with that.
That would entail an amendment to 38 and all.
38 that. And to IFRIC 12 as well, yep. Correct.
Tony?
There's a statement in here that the IFRIC previously said, why are these different? And I'm kind of wondering why these are different. If there's a contractual obligation to pay cash, why is it different? Because that contractual obligation arises in connection with a service concession. So I just wondering why it is that this is different. And the only thing that I could think of, and I'm not sure, but the only thing that I can think of is, okay, you know, in this case, you've got the government on the other side. And what the government is maybe doing is something that is akin to a levy or something that is charged on the revenues of the operator, but I still don't think that helps me, because it's actually contractual in most cases. And I could maybe see it as a slightly different, because the government's on the other side, and it's, you know, are you actually collecting the tolls or whatever it is above a certain level on behalf of the government? But other than that, I'm not quite sure how you could see this differently.
Bob?
I agree with Tony. I did want to raise another, or at least I'm confused, so maybe staff can help me. I was trying to think about the intersection of this with IFRS 15, and if I view the grantor as my customer, in making these payments, though, am I making a payment to my customer, or how do I scope that out, particularly, for example, if I do construction
Correct. And I think that was a consideration when the committee reached a previous discussion, when they said, and the basis for their conclusion was that when you have a financial asset model, that's when the government is really a customer. And they said it's really analogous to making a payment to a customer. And you would look at that time IFRS 18 and now IFRS 15 and when you have the financial asset model. But I think when you have the intangible asset model, they said the customer is really the, they said the customer is more the end user. And in that case, you're making a payment to, not to the customer, but to the government for, in order to acquire the intangible asset. And that's where they went down the path of
right.
the broader issue.
But when I have the intangible asset model, but I did construction on the front end, I have two revenue streams, right?
Correct.
I've got the public as my customer, but I also have the grantor as my customer for the construction, in which the consideration was the intangible. Am I paying a piece of that back through the royalty stream?
Yes, that is a valid consideration. I think the committee, previously the committee felt that it would be the correct way is just to treat it as a payment for an intangible asset and just use it separately in the intangible asset model. But you could have this sort of a hybrid.
But the government is your customer
yeah.
through the construction,
for the construction services.
So when you make a payment subsequently back to the
correct.
Question, why is that not reducing revenue? I think it's a perfectly valid question.
And in the financial asset model, it would be a reduction in the revenue.
Absolutely.
It's just, yes, in the intangible asset model that our previous discussions got to a conclusion that it was an enhancement in the intangible assets. The payment we were making as operator was leading to an enhancement of the asset because we were then going to be able to generate more revenues from the users of the infrastructure.
John?
I think the view from previous discussions was that that in the intangible asset model, the construction and upgrade services plus the cash was the payment for the intangible asset. So it was part of the acquisition of the intangible asset. So, just on carving this out, I mean, I'm not very really that enthusiastic about the extension of the variable lease payment model in the leases project. And essentially you'll be taking it out beyond the scope of leases, which is in IAS 17, and saying we're carving out something that's currently in the scope of IAS 38 and applying this similar model, but we're not going to apply it to other forms of licenses or royalty agreements or anything else that are in 38. So I think we would be, I mean, the only basis for extending it here is to say, well, service concessions are sort of in the nature of leases, but why are they not also in the nature of other long-term license arrangements to do things? I don't know that I see the dividing line necessarily as service concessions go with leases and everything else is goes with asset acquisition variable payments. I suppose I'd be interested in the other thing I think that's important is, I mean, in the leases project some board members felt that it was a sort of a measurement, a cost-benefit consideration because of the volume of leases and the amount of variable payments and the difficulties of measurement and remeasurement. But service concessions, there isn't the same significant, most companies don't have a significant portfolio of these. I mean, they might have a number of these service concessions, but they tend to be fairly limited in number. But there are difficulties in terms of the length of life of them in measurement. So I suppose I'd be interested in board views as to whether they felt there's any real justification for putting these into the leases type model rather than saying, well, they're really just a form of intangible, why carve something out of IAS 38? I mean, I struggle to see the justification for just carving this piece out of IAS 38, I suppose.
Andrew?
I suppose I'd say the reason to push ahead with the IFRIC 12 piece is not particularly conceptual, it's just you've got more chance of actually getting to an answer if we address the smaller subset. One difference I would see that helps me on the is there a liability question, the operator has signed a commitment to operate this concession for a period, so it has surrendered control over its ability to generate future revenues if that is the driver of payments to the government, for example. So I think that is a conceptual difference.
Earl?
Very quickly, I easily can see service concession arrangement as a lease from the government, simply like that. in many cases, it's purely a lease from the government, other than a particular person. Therefore, I think the same approach of the lease would fit very well.
Sue?
On to John's question. I'm not sure, personally speaking, as one board member, that I'd be so convinced on the sort of cost-benefit side as I was for the leases discussion. But I think possibly one thing that might be used here, one of the reasons why I think the board agreed to have the adjustments that occur on the liability side also be adjustments on the asset side in the leases project was because of this close link seen between the value of the liability and the value of the right of use asset. So I think to the example that Wayne gave earlier, if we were convinced that for this population it was easier to see that there could be a relationship between what was happening with the liability measurement and the change in the measurement of the asset, maybe that would be a reason to think about this narrow scope, whereas it's a more open question if you look more broadly at asset acquisitions. Maybe that would be a reason. I don't know if it's enough, but just something to think about.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, did you want to come in on this, or Jim Sue?
When I read this agenda paper to see, because I do not know much about the service concession arrangement, I read the IFRIC 12 one more time. And what I figured out was that IFRIC 12 specifically says that the leasing principle should not be applied to the service concession arrangement because of the rights of the operator is not the same as the rights of the lessee. Lessee has the right of the use of the asset. On the other hand, the operator has the right of the access to the infrastructure or the asset. That's why IFRIC 12 says the right of the service concession arrangement should be intangibles, not the right of use under the leasing principle. But we are talking about applying leasing principle to the service concession arrangement. Seems like something is we are applying something that is not allowed on the original intention of the IFRIC 12. So that is one of my concern. And the other concern is that once we apply the leasing principle to the service concession arrangement, that means we apply the leasing principle to the intangibles. That can be applied to other intangibles or other, you know, more general assets, which I'm really afraid of. I think, what Sue says is a kind of good approach. Sue says that the reason why they designed the leasing principle is because they find out the value of the liability is very close to the value of the asset in the leasing principle. So we have to devise some kind of ideas like that, why leasing principles should be applied to here, like, for example, the value of the asset of the service arrangement concession is the same as the value of the liability created by the service arrangement concession. That is what I come up with. I really don't really support the leasing principles application to the service concession arrangement.
Yeah, to a degree, we may have be suffering from a self-inflicted wound, because I think Tony tried to remind us that the first question you ought to ask is there an asset, is there a liability? The old Reed story construction of how to analyze an issue. And instead, we've, for better or worse, gone off looking for analogies rather than going back to first principles. And that, so we may be suffering a little bit from our own desires. John?
I was going to make a similar comment, just coming back to Andrew's point. One thing we haven't discussed in relation to service concessions, which I think if we're going to go down this path, we will have to consider, is whether the variable payments are really under the control of the operator. Because the operator is obligated to provide the infrastructure for the public to use over a period of the concession. They don't control the users, so there's an argument if they have to make payments based on users, it's actually not a variable payment within the control of the operator at all, and therefore it should be a liability recognized on day one.
That's both situations.
Okay. Let me see if I can capture. On the basic issue, I don't see a consensus around the table. I think if I drew a 45-degree line at probably that end, would say it's not a liability, and therefore, and this end would say it is, except for Sue, because she'd be over there. It's all right. But I don't see a consensus. I also do not see us adding anything to tell the board about what they should do with it that they don't already know. So on the broader issue, it seems to me we are driving to the conclusion that this is just not something this committee is well suited to dealing with. It's too big, too fundamental, too whatever. So let me put that first. Is that also your sense of where we are? Anybody object to that characterization? Okay, then we will need to write an agenda decision in those terms. Now, on the smaller issue of, is there something that can be done with IFRIC 12 and IAS 38, I also don't see a consensus. Again, there are some folks who say, no, it's an intangible asset. Intangible assets are intangible assets. The fact that they arise in the context of this particular transaction doesn't help me. There are others, but I don't see, again, a consensus around getting to that answer either. So I think the task for the staff is to write an agenda decision for us to consider at the next meeting, which will be probably the January video meeting, because that's what we've reserved that January space for, is ratifying and dealing with agenda decisions. Does anybody object to that approach? Okay. Valiant effort to the staff.